Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg, and my co-host Carmen is stuck on the subways in the snowy bowels of Manhattan. Anyway, she will perhaps join us a little later. Depends on the subway lines. But Carmen and I, as you probably know, are garden designers, and our company is Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and our show brings the culture to horticulture. And today, we have an amazing, really great guest. We're going to talk about the future of garden design, public and private, and a new ideology for thinking about the landscapes that surround us. So we were supposed to be live today in the studio, but Blizzard Jonas put a stop to that. And we are going to do our interview via phone. So we have Thomas Rayner and Claudia West joining us. Thomas is a horticultural futurist, fascinated by the intersection of wild plants and human culture. He's a landscape architect by profession and a gardener by obsession. Thomas has worked on projects such as the U.S. Capitol grounds, the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, and the New York Botanic Garden, but is happiest puttering around his small garden in Washington, D.C. And we're hoping to have Claudia on the line. She's the co-author of the book. We're waiting for her to call in. Claudia West is a landscape designer with an extensive background in horticulture, ecology, and environmental restoration. She is a consultant for North Creek Nurseries and has also worked for landscape architects Wolfgang Ulm and Carol Oppenheimer and for Sylvia Native Nursery. So together, they've just written an extraordinary book called Planting in a Post-Wild World, published by Timber Press. So we get asked to review a lot of books by publishers, and only a few get us really, truly excited. And this is one of them. And it's a game changer. We love this book. So Thomas and Claudia, thank you for calling in. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Is Claudia on the line yet or no? Okay, we're trying her again. All right, let me start out. I'd like to read a short paragraph from the preface to the book where Thomas describes his childhood. So Thomas, do you want to read or do you want me to read my earliest memories?
Go ahead. I actually don't have the book in front of me.
Okay. So this is a really powerful place setting, and I love this. It's really great imagery. My earliest memory of wild plants was of the rich spaces they created. A tangled thicket of sparkleberry trees formed narrow paths which we moved through like rabbits. This is you talking about a bunch of boys and friends. A massive southern red oak was our meeting spot, and perhaps most sacred of all was a grove of beeches whose canopy created a dome over a wide creek that flowed between two ridges. We would descend into that bowl in silence, entranced by the light cast through the glowing absinthe leaves. By the time I was in high school, developers had purchased most of that land. The ridges of the forest were dynamited and pushed into the valleys. The streams where we caught crawdads were forced into pipes that flow underneath parking lots. There was once a rich mosaic of woodland plant communities, and now there are housing developments and big box retail stores. My story is not unique. Every day and in every corner of the earth, acre after acre of wildness disappears. For me, the loss of the only authentic landscape I knew as a child is something that stays with me. It roots me in the reality that the wild spaces we have left are but tiny islands surrounded by an ever-growing ocean of developed landscape. There is no going back. But the task that forces us now is not to mourn what is lost, but to open our eyes to see the spaces that surround us every day. Our yards, roads, office parks, malls, woodlots, parks, and cities. Welcome, Thomas.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this it's very interesting because you grew up in Alabama, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I actually grew up in Arlington, Virginia, where you live.
Oh, wow.
Right now. And so Arlington was my footpath kind of to landscape design, and that kind of built environment. And here it is where you've made your call.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So Claudia is, I guess she's not available yet. Let's just jump right into the book. And if she can join us, I'll do an introduction to her. But the book is kind of apocalyptic. It's got a great title, Planting in a Post-Wild World. But after reading through it, we began to feel really hopeful and super excited. You describe a new nature, a sort of hybrid of the cultivated and the wild. And you go on to say that it is too late and impossible to recreate virgin wilderness, but our nostalgia for it can be used to our advantage to turn fragment of that open space to new use. So you call it the third landscape. Can you describe what that means?
Sure. Our focus on the book was really not kind of ecological restoration, all those places, although we absolutely think it's important and hope others do that. Either one of us are really ecologists. We're more students of ecology. We're both interested in using the spaces that really surround humans, urban, mm-hmm. suburban landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that term, third landscape, is one we had borrowed from the French landscape architect. My French is going to be terrible, but I think it's Gilles Clement.
Sure.
and his idea is that kind of this idea of the third landscape. It's really all those leftover fragments where humans live. The little bits of planting around parking lots, the health strips, the medians, the ditches along the sides of the roads, the vacant land and office parks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that confetti of green spaces that really surrounds metro areas. You can kind of zoom out of a Google Earth aerial and really kind of have a sense of how much green is still left, mm-hmm. Even though it's fragmented. And his premise is that, you know, this might be the place eventually, the genetic reservoir for the future. So for me personally, I think kind of that loss of childhood was eventually, you know, which had a lot of sadness and I think even a bit of bitterness about it, was kind of tempered with an understanding that through great creative energy and really understanding how plants grow, we can take all these places within our built landscapes, within these suburban landscapes, and make them more functional, more ecologically functional, and at the same time, still making them horticulture, you know, still making mm-hmm. them something that appeals to people, that responds at an emotional level to us, that pleases us with color and interest and seasonality. So it was really kind of that we turned those spaces that we really turned our attention to.
Your book is described as a guide for designing resilient plant communities. And in the past decade or so, some battle lines have been drawn between gardeners and native plant enthusiasts. You argue that a total different approach is needed, and you talk about naturally occurring versus purely native plants. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I think both of our interests, you know, originally the book was supposed to be called Native Planting Design, and we were both unequivocal advocates of native plants and bringing back in, a lot of those native plants to our design landscapes. And we really feel, not only just for the ecological benefit, but just that these plants' design potential has been totally underappreciated. But at the same time, we also felt like the debate around native plants has gotten a little bit toxic in some ways. Like so many American debates, I think they're so polarized.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not, we really were trying to not just kind of stand on one side of that debate or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Because like a lot of debates, the truth is a bit of the gray in the middle. And it was not turning our back on, you know, the value of native plants at all, but just really wanting to pay more attention to how plants fit together.
Mm-hmm.
And because a lot of what I think is preventing native plants from functioning and being a bigger part of our disturbed landscapes or human landscapes is the fact that people don't know how to combine them together. And
right.
They really don't understand how to work with them.
Right.
It's hard for a native sedge to really compete with a blooming diva like a rose or a hydrangea sometimes.
Right.
It's really,
yeah.
You know, they're still great functional plants, and it's really in combination or in mass
right.
or kind of tucked underneath something else that these plants' aesthetic value really stands out.
Mm-hmm.
So for us as both designers and people who love native plants, we thought our contribution to this debate was not to kind of deepen the divide, but really to talk about how plants fit together in the wild. And by wild, we mean both in the native wild, as well as naturally occurring plant communities like weeds,
mm-hmm.
where you get a remarkable density and diversity of plants literally growing on top of each other.
Right.
And we felt there were huge lessons to be learned from the way plants grow in these patterns. And we felt like if we focused on that as opposed to what is said on the plant's passport, that we'd be kind of pushing forward and possibly even providing some middle ground that might unite,
mm-hmm.
You know, the horticulturalists who love their dahlias and their peonies, as well as the native plant lovers who are, you know, very passionate in their zeal for bringing this species back.
Right, right. And what we loved about your book was that you focus on the future and not some kind of romantic view, as you say, about what plants grew there in the past. Most of our daily environments bear no resemblance to actual nature. You know, they're so built, the built environment, you know, in mm-hmm. a garden world. You know, that's such a phrase, the built environment, but you know, it's applicable to the plant world as well, I think.
Right.
Right. So you're really arguing for a new nature that is designed and managed by us, and you call these plant mm-hmm. communities, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we were focusing on design plant communities because these are, for us, these are places in human landscapes. These are managed landscapes in one way or the other. And really, these plantings could be anywhere on a gradient from, you know, someone's highly managed ornamental perennial border type all the way to, you know, something that's much more functionally managed, something like a rain garden or I even think this method would really work well for the type of landscapes that Department of Transportation staff manage along sides of the roads.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they're interested in some amount of biodiversity, they're interested in aesthetic effects,
mm-hmm.
Interested in, but don't have the resources to really maintain and deadhead every little plant. They're doing this kind of at a larger scale. So,
right. That is such an amazing. I think along the highways, it's such an amazing use of underutilized space.
Right.
You know, I love, my husband is from Knoxville, Tennessee, so we spend a lot of time going down Route 81 through Virginia. And what they've done in those medians with wildflowers is just phenomenal. Like, it's a treat. But unfortunately, we go down two or three times a year. Unfortunately, it's only really like a summer kind of show. And I think obviously we're going right through the the Blue Ridge, so that in itself is gorgeous. But I think there could be so many more interesting things that happen, like you say, with these communities. Can you classify them?
I'm not sure. So the idea of the way that scientists classify plant communities is very varied, and one of the things you realize the way people used to think, or ecologists in particular, used to think of plant communities as these kind of super organisms that work together for the good of the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And really, ecology has no longer thinks of plant communities in these ways. In some ways, a plant community is really nothing more than a frame by which we look at any group of overlapping populations at any one moment.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really entirely human constructs. So sometimes people define plant communities at a biome level. Sometimes they get very, very specific, down to very specific populations within a certain area. What's interesting, though, about kind of the idea of a plant community, at least in the scientific terms, is just that these are human constructs. And as such, there really aren't any kind of preconditions for what plants make a plant community. It's kind of plants that are all adapted to the same place. And in general, there's kind of a sorting of plants into different niches and layers, as they kind of battle each other out and find the spots that each fit. It's not that there's not competition in these. In fact, there's quite a bit of competition, but over time, and the more they get distributed, the more the plants kind of fit into slots where they have the best chances of survival.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of that process that seems so appealing and so different than what we are typically seeing in our gardens and landscapes. And what we thought would be, if we really studied that and kind of started to understand how are these plants sorting themselves, what kind of competition are they using, what are the different layers, and could, generalize some of those principles to horticulture, we felt like it would be a really a strong way of kind of getting closer toward a horticulture that more closely resembles the way plants coexist in the wild.
Right. You have a beautiful picture in the preface of your book, and you talk about the spirit of plants, a seeded mix of sweet pea and fescue growing in a parking lot in Boulder, Colorado. And it's stunning. I mean, it's so gorgeous and so simple, you know?
Right.
And then you have on the next page, Mexican feathergrass, catmint, meadow sage, and alliums, all intermingled. And that is actually in your garden, and it's just the most gorgeous palette, of spiky and texture and scented. It's just beautiful. I love how things work together.
Yeah, I think what we're excited about, too, is that I really feel like this idea about plant communities, or at least plant communities inspiring design, feels to me like this could be a new renaissance for horticulture.
Yeah.
Because in the last few years, if you think about, I speak a lot about horticulture, and you hear a lot of depressing statistics about it. It was on top 20 most useless degrees a couple of years ago. I saw a lot of the hort programs across the country are closing down or getting smaller.
Right.
Garden clubs are losing memberships right and left. So there's a lot of kind of bad statistics about millennial interest in gardening, that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
But when I feel like, not only just that there's a lot of ecological potential here, but I just feel like, being inspired by the mixing of plants in the wild and how that can really inform garden making really can just blow the doors wide open on design. As a designer, I'm very excited by the potentials because I feel like, a designer like Pete Aldoff, who's really inspired so many people.
Right.
It's just kind of one variation of a theme this could take. So I am super excited by the number of young horticulturalists I'm seeing out there, inspired in one way or the other by kind of this idea of wild functioning plant communities and what it can mean in terms of just design expressions.
I
think there'll be so many new ones coming out there that it's really an exciting time.
Yeah, and people, they're doing super interesting things. There's this great group called Emergence, and a woman named Bryn Govna Arthur, who is in North Carolina, and she in her suburban landscape. I don't know if you know her work, but she is doing huge swaths of ancient grains as ornamentals. Wow. And it is stunning. And she's completely changed her whole community and the way people interact with each other. And she's mm-hmm. growing sorghum and wheat and, like, you know, as ornamentals, but like in these huge swaths, so that they're beautiful, you know, and
sounds amazing.
It's really right. great. We have to take a break. Hang on to the line, Thomas. We'll be right back. And I want to get more kind of in depth in the book. We have to take a break. Stay tuned to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
Keeping everybody on the toes now, making it so hard to keep our balance, balancing between the people we want.
Hello out there, it's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants. Today we're talking with Thomas Rainier and his new book by Timber Press, Planting in a Post-Wild World. So Thomas, in your book, you go into depth about finding inspiration in the wild and why we respond to certain landscapes the way we do as an emotional response rooted in our biology. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I loved that idea.
Sure. It was fascinating in doing some of the research for the book how much of the field of environmental psychology really explains our emotional reactions to certain landscapes. You know, if you think about it, we've spent so much of our history as a species interacting with plants and being out in the wild. It's really only in the last probably 100 years or so, of the thousands of years of our species we've been alive, that we've been removed from these environments.
Mm-hmm.
So much of our association with spaces is a response to either safety or opportunity or fear in one way or the other. So, you know, a lot of theories about why lawn and trees, which is kind of the predominant feature of suburban landscapes and American parks,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's kind of a memory of savanna-like landscapes, which tend to be highly productive landscapes. You know, these are some of the earliest landscapes we evolved from, where hunting was plentiful, you had long views, you were kind of sheltered by certain trees. So
mm-hmm.
The idea that, you know, even this modern age where we spend more time kind of reflecting on our smartphones and backlit screens than we do staring at the stars or, you know, looking, finding our way home by charting the plants in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
Even in an age like this, we respond at an emotional level to plants,
mm-hmm.
And which is partly why I think you think about the High Line in Manhattan as the most visited site in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of, I think, the power of that planting is not just great horticultural craftsmanship, though there's plenty of that there. You know, what that is really a relic. You know, it's something that is playing with the memory of the wild spontaneous vegetation that used to grow on mm-hmm. that rail line.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it was just pretty, it would be interesting, but the power in that is that it is a memory of a meadow that you can have while you float between the skyscrapers.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when planting becomes more than just being pretty, more than just kind of parsley around the pot roast, which is what, you know, so much of horticulture has been.
Yeah, that's a nice phrase.
An evocation of the spaces that our bodies and our psyche is meant to be in, then planting design, to me, it becomes an art. You know, I mean, to me, that's the game I'm after. It's not just kind of pulling off a few pretty combinations, which is,
right,
you know, always fun to do. It's when a small patch of planting can remind you or just takes you away, gives you the feeling of walking through the woods or mm-hmm. a sun-dappled moment in a forest. To me, uh-huh. that is the power that planting design really can be, particularly the balm that it can be for city-goers in the future.
Exactly.
We'll need those moments more and more.
Yeah. So tell us about, because in your book you have some landscape archetypes, grasslands, woodlands, forests. Can you tell us about each of those and how you think we experience each of those?
Sure. Claudia and I struggled a lot with kind of how do you take the complexity of all the different plant communities that are out in the world and, you know, kind of find some kind of system for summarizing those. And we churned a lot of stomach acid thinking about, you know, coming up with a system that didn't overly simplify that. And ultimately, we did end up with just three archetypes, which, you know, maybe, which is a simplification for sure. But ultimately, I think we felt very comfortable with that because if you're trying to replicate something that feels like a moment in the wild, getting overly specific often can cloud the purposes rather than, you know, you're getting bogged down with too many details.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, if your inspiration is as pure and distilled form of that natural community as possible, then you're pulling off of an inspiration that has more universal appeal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody in southern England, an oak hickory forest may not mean very much to them like it does to me here in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But a forest is something that almost everyone in the temperate world understands at some intuitive level. So we liked kind of the three, the grassland, and that to us is any place, any kind of urban landscape where you have mostly sunny space. You know, the patterns of the grassland make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
The woodland and shrubland was a highly variable kind of category, which includes in the wild things like these are places where there are trees that are present but the canopy's not touching, so Mediterranean, you know, things like scrublands in California, mm-hmm. or Spain or the Mediterranean,
mm-hmm.
Lots of landscapes, the dry landscapes where trees are present but they're not really touching.
Mm-hmm.
And so these kind of have some patterns of openness and closeness, and in suburban and urban landscapes, plenty of places, particularly in the suburbs, we think kind of woodland and shrublands make a lot of sense because you have these patterns of openness, also these clusters of trees,
mm-hmm.
Where you do get some moments of shade. So it really felt like that inspiration was a really underutilized one in suburban landscapes. And then the last one was forest. And this, for us, this make a lot of sense for when canopy is actually touching,
mm-hmm.
when you really have kind of a closed dome of trees. And
mm-hmm.
so the patterns of you know, trees being close together, and then that wonderful expression of the forest floor, where sometimes the shrubs start dropping out, and you have this very legible layered system of floor and ceiling, you know,
mm-hmm.
the canopy of the trees,
mm-hmm.
Was kind of a great inspiration.
Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating. I'm listening to you talk, and of course I'm thinking about each one of my own personal experiences in these environments,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's the beauty of your book is you're teaching people to, it is very personal, you know, and by it is inspirational when you, that was one of the words you used, kind of versus detail, you know, and I remember as a kid, you know, doing hiking in, you know, Maine versus,
right.
the Blue Ridge, you know, it's two very
right.
different environments, and I love them equally. I can't make a distinction, you know.
Right.
But then, you know, there you are faced with a client And then the client is telling you kind of some of their memories and what, you know, what their ideal landscape is. But then they have another one and another one. And it's very hard to kind of pull these together in these small spaces, you know?
It is. Yes, I think that's true. And I think to the extent that we can kind of pull off of what is existing in the landscape and amplify existing features that we want to keep.
Right.
You know, sometimes we don't have any or it's a lot of invasive plants or something, but if there is a nice cluster of trees that, and shrubs that have, some, even an inkling of feeling or pattern that, might be helped by that inspiration, that I think, looking for those cues. And really, I think having just, I think this is where, for as a designer, being able to go out in the wild as much as possible is such a great point of inspiration. There's not a hike I take that I don't come away with some thoughts about planting design.
Exactly.
I mean, the patterns are so rich. The combinations are so interesting. There's just, nature really is the greatest teacher. I think for designers, building up that library in your brain of those moments becomes really, hey, this reminds me of, or if we just added a little bit of this over here, we could start kind of get that feeling of this.
Right.
And so I think if you're motivated by kind of a feeling of, I want to regain that feeling of high elevation, views, or I want that feeling of how when you get to this kind of the boulders, the way that rocks spill around boulders, the plants spill around the boulders in this area. So.
Right. Above the tree line and exactly.
Right.
And that the look of that, blueberry, that scrub blueberry and the scrub raspberry next to that granite boulder is, it's
that's right.
Just jaw dropping,
Yep.
It's uplifting. So, there's a chapter on the design process, and you say, gardens were once a refuge from the wild, but now we turn to them for an experience of the natural world. So with that goal in mind, what principles should guide the design process? And how is the design process for creating these new landscapes different from the typical process, do you think?
Well, I think if we're starting with coming to our landscapes with a goal, plant community in mind, there's this one of those three archetypes that we started with.
Grassland, really woodland, kind of, or forest.
Thinking about kind of what aspects of those we want to recall, or how can we, in a very small landscape, capture some moment of that. So if we're going to do grassland, that's fine, but maybe we want to really amplify light catching grasses, and so we're using more feathery and fluorescent ones, or maybe that's not it at all. Maybe we want to do a forb rich wet meadow. Really want to kind of amplify the feeling of color. These seasonal themes that could come in. So kind of deciding what, and a lot of that will be based on what your clients want to do. A lot will be based on what you can do, what your budget can do. I think then starting thinking about, I think once you have the goal community in mind, then you can start thinking about palette. Mm-hmm. And, palette will be determined in large extent by what could grow there, what type of plants want to grow in a site like that, understanding your soil, but then also really the design goals you have. I think so much of what we wanted this process to be guided by was a rich conversation with a client, and really shaped by goals.
Mm-hmm.
In that, those kind of, understanding what the goals of the site are. We want a bunch of waves of color flowers coming in, or we want this to be quiet and green because we want this to feel like kind of a wet edge next to a stream, or whatever those kind of initial impulses are going to be the cue that holds together both the palette and then later on in the management stage, that will be the same kind of goals you return to help you manage those.
Management. I'm glad you said that. That's the long term. That's what makes it work. So you also say that there should be legibility in the design layer and diversity in the functional layer, and how a stunning example of this in practice with the photos of a garden by landscape architect Heinz Lutz. What does that mean in practice?
So one of the I think kind of the hallmark of the method we tried to describe was this idea that all plant communities in the wild are layered.
Mm-hmm.
And they're vertically layered. And so if you think about any plant community in the wild, whether it's a weedy patch of weeds in a lawn or something you'd see in a forest or in a native meadow, almost all those plant communities are vertically layered. So the plants we see at eye level are really not necessarily the ones that are holding the ground. And if you kind of get on your hands and knees in a meadow or in a forest floor and really start looking at almost all the plant community has is green mulch everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Plants' function in the wild is to cover ground. And plants do this with a great diversity of different kind of competitive strategies and morphologies, different shapes in the way they do that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what we tried to do in the book was to explain, to translate this natural layering system into a horticultural language. And so in the book, we describe kind of three simple layers, which more or less apply to most plant communities. The first, kind of starting at the ground layer, would be a ground cover layer. And this is important because this is what we use basically as mulch in most of our American landscapes. We use kind of bark mulch mm-hmm. as a ground cover for a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
But in many ways, not that mulch is bad, but our habit of perpetually adding 2 inches of mulch twice a year keeps our plantings in a perpetual establishment phase. We're not really allowing plants to do the role that they're wanting to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these are things like native sedges would naturally do in a lot of different environments.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of creeping and crawling plants that really hold the base. They tend to be very shade tolerant in this layer.
Mm-hmm.
But there are the workhorses. And so in this layer, we call this the functional layer.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to get as much density and diversity in this layer as possible. Because again, this is all about functionally holding the ground. Bare soil is really the enemy in plant communities.
Right.
And then your upper two layers, we talked about kind of a structural layer and a seasonal theme layer, are really what we call the design layers. And what's interesting about this is while the bottom layer, the ground cover layer, is more functional, these are the ones you see more at eye level. So things like patterns, massing, become much more important. Drifts, you know, this is where a designer gets his design.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a lot of ways, even though we're talking about mixed planting, interplanted, which, you know, I think a lot of people associate with weedy, messy, chaotic type organization, you still can have a lot of the craft of design happening in the upper layers while you're getting mm-hmm. density and diversity in the lower layers.
Sure.
And that to us is very exciting because in some ways, you know, what you're not really paying attention to much in the ground layer becomes very aesthetic in its own way. You know, when you think about the massive azaleas by themselves are nice, but, you know, when they're not blooming, they're kind of boring. You get a lot of mulch behind them, you know.
Yeah.
Getting kind of a layer of blue and green sedges underneath them makes them much more attractive,
mm-hmm.
Much more functional planting.
Mm-hmm.
So for a lot of gardeners, I think, just thinking about looking at the mulch in your landscape and replacing those with the very large range of native perennials that you can kind of underplant is a great first step in
mm-hmm.
just making your landscape more functional.
Mm-hmm.
But for designers, I think the opportunity in those upper two layers, the seasonal theme layer, which is really about those waves of color, and Heiner Lutz, that landscape architect from Germany, has just some really amazing examples. I think we have some images of a public park he did in Germany that's just covered. It's basically a modular mix of 20 or more species. But at every moment from May to November, there's one or two plants blooming that lights up the whole planting.
Right.
And so he's really a master of, even though it's mixed and modular, and a lot mm-hmm. of people in a public park might look at that and say it's a weedy mess, is so colorful, and it's just kind of one wave of seasonal themes after the next that it's unmistakably designed.
Right.
And it's beautiful and appealing.
Right.
And so James Hitchin and Nigel Dunn in England are doing a lot of the same thing. Seeded mixes. I mean, we just see a lot of potential for people taking mixed planting And then it becomes repetition and, mm-hmm. you know, percentages become the designer's way of having impact more than massing in patterns.
The percentage?
Yeah, in some ways, you know, focusing like, for the seasonal theme plant, having enough, of example, in that case, it was bearded irises and salvia in that one image, but having enough of that in each layer, you know, having the percentages right so that right. when your season, that layer is in bloom, it lights up the whole planting.
Uh-huh.
Or having two or three in combination. I mean, I think that one is working really well with that. So, you know, the design tools become more about the sequence of bloom and having enough and repeating plants than about what designers traditionally do is, you know, massing plants in individual blocks and getting layers that way.
Uh-huh. I'm thinking a lot about Noel Kingsbury, and I'm also thinking about Roy Diblick. Do you know his work?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, he does some really amazing things out in Chicago.
Yes.
Which is, so at the end of your book, you have a few gardens and you kind of, that use these principles that you outline. And one that really spoke to Carmen, Carmen's not here, but Carmen loved the Derek Foreman's Prospect Cottage at Dungeness on the English mm-hmm. coast. And you say that this garden has achieved a kind of cult status. It's a great story. Can you tell us about its maker and how it exemplifies your ideas?
Yeah, we try to end the book with showing three different gardens. And the reason we wanted to do that is because I think we felt, because we were so inspired by wild plantings, that people would think that only wild plants, you know, only kind of a wild-looking garden would right. result from that. And we wanted to show three gardens that they're very different stylistically. We had one highly formal, historic one with boxwood parterres where these principles were used. Mm-hmm. James Golden in New Jersey had a very kind of wild garden. But then Derek Jarman's property in Dungeness off England was one that was really inspiring because it was so whimsical. This is an amazing film producer who spent the last few years of his life, I think while he was dying with AIDS, he built this beautiful garden on one of the most punishing environments on the coast of England. It was basically
right.
gardening in pure pebble. Mm-hmm. And so we had this black, pure kind of tar-coated, simple beach cottage.
Right.
Beautiful little kind of super simple place.
Mm-hmm.
And he just started playing in the pebbles with seed mixes. And the gardens that resulted is probably one of the most photographed and popular gardens in England. But it was just this mix of plants that was so adapted to the site.
Right.
And I think, you know, what was so amazing was not only just this, you know, these waves of beautiful color against this black sea cottage, but the sea cottage was positioned looking at a nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
So everything about the site has a post-apocalyptic Mad Max kind of feel to it, because
right.
there are all these post-industrial barges left over. There's all this, you know, just leftover industrial debris with this nuclear power plant, and this wonderful artist in the midst of, you know, a harsh end-of-life struggle.
Right.
Creating this joyous, ebullient gardening. And for me, personally, I mean, I can't think of a more optimistic call to action than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's really just... It was whimsical, too. It wasn't, you know, I think this is the other thing there's so much about planting and the themes of this book that were heavy, and thinking about this future with climate change and the loss of natives in the wild, that to think about plants and the irrepressible spirit that plants have in the wild, and this one particular garden where facing these awful windswept, seed salt battered ramshackle beach looking at the nuclear power plant with this waves of colors bursting out of it was so hopeful and just reminded me and, you know, I hope other readers of the joy and the ebullience and really the reason why we plant it all. You know, gardens are not meant to endure. They're meant to enchant.
Right.
And having more layered life ultimately is you know, it's good for the environment. You know, you're getting more biodiversity in landscapes. But ultimately, it's about our pleasure as well. And that particular garden to me was just such a poignant reminder of that.
Yeah.
That we felt like we had included the book.
Well, I'm glad you did. And I think it's the perfect end note to your beginning childhood memories about place and stimulation, I think, at the beginning of life and at the end. I think, you know, plants are resilient and, you know, I think the more we learn about them and the more we can read and realize that we are part of a much larger process,
right.
And the fact that we have the ability to affect some sort of change in beauty on our built environment is the most important thing we can do, you know?
Well said.
So I really thank you for your work. And this book is, it really is like a game changer with regard to, you know, the millennia of design books out there. And, you know, they're all so good. But this is, you've kind of captured the spirit, I think, of plants and of people. And it's really lovely. And I really look forward to meeting you on Thursday at Plantarama, which was canceled. It was supposed to be tomorrow. And you are still snowed in, or I guess the airports are kind of still digging out. You're in Washington, D.C. So you will come
right.
in when? Tomorrow or the next day?
Yeah, I'll be there on Wednesday.
Okay, great. Well, I will come and find you at Plantarama. And thank you for joining us.
I sure enjoyed it. Thanks
and
for
thanks
having.
For your book. Okay. This show was written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Remember to join our Facebook fan page, Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants. Join us on Twitter at We Dig Plants. And to stay current on our projects and our upcoming shows, follow us on Instagram at Groundworks Gardens NYC. Thanks for listening and see you in the virtual garden.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.